Good morning, everyone. Many of you know I've been away for most of 3 months with a cameo appearance once or twice during that time. I've been away on writing retreat, and I have finished the book I was writing, so yeah. So for better or worse, you'll be seeing me more often now. It'll take a few more months to get the book published, but it's the story of 44 years of life with Swami Kriyananda, and I think it's what it's supposed to be, so I feel quite impersonal about it now. It's like a grown child that I've sent off into the world, although it hasn't quite manifested its form yet, but it is what it is, and it has, I think, a very happy destiny, and I hope that you all will get to share in it before too long. Okay, well, thank you. Enough. I appreciate the enthusiasm. You all have been incredibly supportive and have walked a lot of the agonizing miles of this journey with me. So I think your relief isn't as great as mine, but you do have some of it too, because at least you're not going to have to hear about it endlessly anymore. All right. Our topic today, Divine Light, is really what could be better. You know, we're getting around to the 4th of July, which we celebrate with burst of beautiful light in terms of fireworks, also with a lot of horrible noise, but the burst of beautiful light, just because it's inherently thrilling to see that kind of beauty and power. I've always had a tremendous enthusiasm for fireworks, not for the noise, but for just all the beauty of it. So many things in this world are reminiscent of divine and astral memories that we have. And those of us who have spiritual inclinations in our lives have had the opportunity between our incarnations to live in worlds that are really filled with beautiful light. And so whenever we see anything on this planet that represents that, or we ourselves pour ourselves out to try to recreate that, Swamiji said we have this desire to recreate the atmosphere in which we feel comfortable. And so you do see people who recreate dark brown, heavy, confused vibrations in their living spaces or whatever else they do, or stark, sort of heartless creations, because that's the vibration they feel the most comfortable with. I'm always astonished sometimes when I see some architecture, especially big, really expensive things, I think they had all the money in the world and they did that. You know, like, what kind of a consciousness would think that if I could do anything, I would do that? I mean, on the positive side, when I visited Thailand for the first time many years ago, when we used to travel regularly to India on the pilgrimage tours, which we did for about 20 years, coming back from India, we'd stop at various places in that part of the world on our free tickets. But the first time I went to Thailand, and I went to the palace, of course the royal palace is the most extreme example, and their aesthetic is, to my mind, absolutely beautiful, but incredibly detailed, extremely tiny, you know, tiny, tiny, little, even more than what you see in India, very exact, and very complicated, and you stand back from it for just a moment and think, you know, what kind of a consciousness that could do anything at all would do that? You know, it helps you understand culture, it helps you understand how arbitrary things are, just because I'm in Thailand in the moment in my mind. The first time we went through Thailand, we had gone on the airline that stopped there. We flew on Thai Airways. So we had an overnight, and they put us up in the most luxurious hotel I'd ever been in my life, the Royal Orchid in Bangkok. And for breakfast, somebody gets up really early with this little sharp knife and makes art out of all the fruit. So the watermelons and the peaches, everything, again, tiny, tiny little cuts. I mean, they do it very fast. But you come out and your breakfast is an art piece like that. And once again, you think, like, what kind of a consciousness, you know, if I would just put the peach on the table, you know, because in a short time somebody's going to eat it. It's just going to go away, or you're going to give it to the monkeys, or whatever's going to happen. But it was still worthwhile putting all that energy in to make even the most mundane thing beautiful. You see how many choices there are in life? That's what happens to us when we travel, is that we suddenly realize that what we thought was fixed was not really fixed, it was arbitrary. And when we visited Swami Kriyananda once when he was in seclusion in this little cottage in Rishikesh, and it was with our pilgrimage group, so we had like 35 people, many of whom were being in India for the first time. India now is modernizing so fast that what we experienced in the 80s and in the 90s is very, very different than what you find there. But Swamiji was talking about, he'd been walking through the streets of Rishikesh at that point, and he thought to himself, in America they would keep these streets cleaner. And then he thought to himself, and then you would have clean streets. And he just paused and asked, you know, like, how important is it to have clean streets? I mean, is this an eternal value? Is this something that when I have my life review, God is going to say, good for you, you kept the streets clean? Like, what really matters? And then he talked about, in that context, he talked about many other things. You know, if inner values are more important, sometimes the outer world gets neglected. Now, right now, what's happening is everything is coming together. East and West, inner and outer, we're coming into a new age. And in that new age, both are possible. But we still get a little confused, you know. So we spend a lot of energy having clean streets. When Master was alive and he told the monks, one of the ways to keep your house, your room tidy is whenever you finish using something, put it away. Extremely practical advice. At the end of Swami Kriyananda's life, he got credit for being very tidy because he had housekeepers who kept him very tidy. On his own, before he had a staff, he was not tidy. Very simply, Master said to put everything away, that takes too much time. That's just how he put it. He preferred to just leave everything out because everything was being used, whatever it was, and he could just wend his way through and it didn't bother him. It just wasn't. Having a clean house just didn't matter to him. What mattered to him was the creativity that was passing through him, and that's all. So in our reading today, what we're talking about is this fundamental reality, which is the power of light. And I was remembering also, it was almost 15 years ago, I believe, a woman who named Linda, who was a member of our congregation here, she went through, I believe, two rounds of cancer over a period of a decade. And the second round of cancer took her life. And when it came back for the second time, and she realized that she was very likely not going to survive, she and her husband went to Assisi, where Swami was at the time, because she wasn't sure she would still be alive when he came back to the U.S. So we flew over with her, and she was there. But she said to Swami, just really simply, like, what do I do now? You know, do I pray to be healed? You know, do I pray to die beautifully? Do I say goodbye to my family? Do I, you know, what do I do? What's my prayer at this point? It's an obvious question, because merely because we have a strong desire in a certain direction, it does not necessarily mean that that's where God wants us to go. Nor does it mean it's not where God wants us to go. None of these issues can be decided on the basis of dogma. They have to be decided on the basis of intuition. And she was wise enough to realize that, you know, she was attached to her husband and her children and her home, and she didn't trust her own judgment. What do I pray for? She asked. And Swami's answer was perfect, and I've meditated on it many times ever since. Pray to be in the light. That's what he said to her. Pray to be in the light. Now, when we have all these ripples that go over our consciousness. You know, we live on a restless lake of conflicting and cross currents. You know, it's just, I do. I'm not going to pose it on all of you. But, you know, calm silence, perfect stillness, it's nice when it comes. I was just to go back for a moment, when I was very first at Ananda Village in the 70s, this book I've lived through my whole life, so you're going to hear a lot of autobiography, more than you usually do for the next few months until I forget. But one of those times, I was Swami's secretary in the early 70s, and I spent many hours with him. And one evening, Seva and I were there, and we'd had dinner together, and we were just sitting and talking. And for some reason, he was sitting in such a way that he was relating to Seva, but I was out of his line of sight. Seva's a woman friend of mine who's still at Ananda. She worked with Swami a great deal. I was sitting over here, and this unusual stillness came over my mind. I was conscious of the fact that I was getting a much welcome respite from the usual chatter. So I was just quietly sitting there enjoying it. And Swami said to Seva, is Asha still here? Asha, are you here? And I said, yes, sir, I'm here. And then he just said in a very friendly way, why can't I feel your mind? I said, because it's unusually calm, sir. And he never turned around. He just shut his eyes. He said, ah, yes, there you are. Just like that. So most of us live in this roiling sea of mental cross currents, don't we? I want this, I want that, yesterday, tomorrow, just endlessly. But what we're looking for on the spiritual path is not to ride that duality. We're always riding that duality, and most people in the world just push that duality. It's like, if I can just get it organized the way I want it, if I can just get the street clean, then I will have clean streets. You know, I'll be able to have things just my way. I mean, think about how much time and energy we spend to get it just our way. And think how soon it isn't anymore. For one reason or another, people have an extremely annoying way of not cooperating with our plans for them. The planet itself has a very annoying way of not cooperating. You know, many of you know Michael Gornick and his beautiful, well, what was his beautiful place on the Big Island of Hawaii. He had this beautiful place he's been working on for years called Polestar, which is now apparently the tiny island in an absolute lake of black lava, because the volcano on that island has just decided to create another island. You know, these things just happen. And so whenever we stake ourselves out in anything, you know, I am of an age where I now look at pictures of myself and I think, my gosh, was that me? You know, you can see the same eyes and you can sort of a lot of times remember the moment, and being a woman, I can remember the dress. You know, I can usually remember where I bought it and how long I had it, you know, what I finally did with it. But still, you look at that, and what a surprise, you know? But it was so real when it was happening. But when we put ourselves into any of those ripples, the inevitable other side will always come. And so my dear friend Linda, who out of the beauty of her soul and the goodness of her heart, had created a really gorgeous life for herself. You know, in so many ways, very, very good karma, and well-deserved. But all of a sudden, the body was going to die. And when the body dies, where does it all go? I mean, as far as we're concerned, it's not there anymore. I remember Swamiji was approached once. There was an initiative on the California ballot once, an anti-nuclear initiative. It was started from Palo Alto, as so many things in the world start from Palo Alto. And it was a spiritually based, very well-intentioned movement to campaign against war. I mean, like, duh, isn't that a good idea? And so they had a very effective presentation, and one of their representatives came to Ananda and wanted Swamiji to endorse it and wanted Swami to put Ananda's energy behind it. You might think it's a no-brainer, but it depends on your perspective. So they gave an extremely effective presentation, but it was all based on what happens when nuclear bombs hit dense population areas, which it doesn't take much to figure out. A lot of people die. And they explained how everybody dies. The epicenter is vaporized. These people leave ash. You know, these last another week. You know, just it goes out and it's horrific. And Swami listened to it all. And then when they were done, he commended them on their sincerity, the intelligence with which they were going at it. And then he had two interesting comments. The first one was, he said, you know, in 100 years, almost no one living on this planet is still going to be on this planet. All of us will have gone away. So this idea that somehow we must stop death is kind of a lost cause because it's inevitable for everyone. And then he said, once you're in the astral world, he said, whether we have dribbled off over 100 years or have all left the planet in one big whoosh, he says it doesn't matter at all. You know, from this side, it matters so much, doesn't it? He said, but once it's over, once you've stepped out of this body, you've just stepped out of this body. Once I walk off of this dais and walk back into the other room, I'll just have walked into the other room. And from a certain reality, a tremendous thing will have happened. But in terms of my own consciousness, so little. I just walked from here to there. You know, and everything that is powerful that happens in this room, it'll still be with me when I'm in that room. And just all that happens is this little bit of a change in form. But when we have invested ourselves and defined ourselves and made our reality on the temporary, we are so vulnerable. And we know that. I mean, we feel it. That's the fundamental tension that everyone is living with. And whether we constantly distract ourselves with noise and entertainment and good company and high hopes and this time it's going to be different. You know, every incarnation we come in, this time it's going to be different. You know, this time I'm going to get it just right. You know, just right. This time, Master said that reincarnation, we reincarnate, we want to reincarnate. Not because it was a disaster, but because it was almost correct. That's the most frustrating part. It always almost works. It just comes so close to working that we're certain, just a tiny adjustment. But insofar as we have depended on the temporary, no matter how beautiful, no matter how beautiful, no matter how heart-feeling, no matter how God-remembering, we are vulnerable and we always know it. You know, it's fascinating when your mind gets calm enough to just trace down whatever anxiety you feel. I mean, you can trace it up is another way to trace it. But deeper and deeper, what is it? Why am I worried? What am I tense about? Why does that make me sad? You know, why do I desire that? And it, believe me, just to name it is not to free yourself from it. But if one constantly just keeps on following through, then you always find it's always because I want it to be different than it is. I just want it to be different than it is. I want to make my own rules, and then I want the world to conform. You know, try it. How's that working for you? It really didn't work very well for me. Maybe you've got something I don't know. But what Swami said to Linda when she prayed is, be in the light. In your body, out of your body, in your beautiful home with your wonderful family, in the astral world, with everybody that you love on that side that you don't remember anymore, but, oh, there they are. Oh, how nice to see you again. And then you look back at these souls and you realize, what have I identified with? That you are my husband, my son, my child, that this building was mine, that this is my furniture and here's my jewelry? Or is it that we loved each other? And together we did something so beautiful. Because the other side of it is, much of the divine expresses in this world. So it's a weird thing that we it takes time to get your mind around it. And I know people have gotten, I want to say mad at me, I'll call them annoyed. They get annoyed with the principles of self-realization and sometimes they take it out on me. because I'm the one who told them. So they figure if they can argue with me, maybe they won't have to do it. Okay? Why are you always so negative about this is a beautiful world? Yeah. I mean, it can be. I've seen it look nicer than it's looking right now, but those were in other yugas than this one. You know, this is what you get. We thought it was a good idea to incarnate in the transition between Kali Yuga and Dwapara Yuga, between a lower and a higher age, and this is what happens. That's what I say to myself. That's my little mantra. What did you expect? What did you expect? This is what happens. We're pioneers. We're the first wave of energy. We're planting seeds. There's lots of great words, but none of them actually change the fact that light and darkness are at war right now. And it's, you know, it's hairy, and it might get hairier. And we might, a lot of us might find ourselves in the astral world all at once. We'll be the lucky ones, the ones who have to hang around and deal with all of whatever happens next. It will be a challenge. So what shall we do? Shall we identify with the temporary, or shall we be in the light? Because when we're clinging to a form, we're clinging to it because we believe that in that form, I will find what I want. And what do I want? Well, here's a simple phrase. I want to be in the light. Don't we? However we call it, it's the same thing that we're all looking for. I want to be able to overcome my sorrow and my suffering, and I want to feel who I know I am meant to be, which is a child of God in attunement with that Sat-Chit-Ananda, ever-conscious, ever-new, ever-existing, ever-self-aware bliss. That's why this world is so annoying. If there were really no hope, we would relax and accept it, because it wouldn't even occur to us that it could be otherwise. But inside of us is this pulse that says you were born for bliss. And so we say, bliss, bliss, that's right, that means this, that means this, that means this. And it's just a terrible misunderstanding. It's not more than that. It's like we're not dark, we're bliss. It's just that we get confused. Have you ever seen little children, very small children, be more interested in the box the toy came in than the toy itself? And then you can interpret that in many different ways, but part of that, it's a very perfect analogy for us, isn't it? Divine Mother says you were made for bliss, but oh, this is how you have to do it. And then they give us the examples of these masters, and you know, you have really examples that contradict common sense. You have poor Jesus was crucified. We don't, most of us don't say, oh goody, this lifetime I get to be crucified. You know, we don't think like that. We don't think that to be crucified is to be in the light. So you have an extreme example like Jesus, who was from a darker age than this one. You know, in this age, the avatar Yogananda lived in a beautiful building in Los Angeles. I like that better. I like that better. But that doesn't mean that he was less willing. It's whatever God gives, this is what I take. Because if I'm in the light, then it all comes back to me that way. You know, there's another part of that story that was in the reading that James shared with us that was very touching to me. And the wonderful thing about these writings of the masters is that you can hear the same thing over and over again. You know, I've been doing these Sunday readings for 30-some years now. So when I open the book and I see it, I don't always read every word because I know, oh, it's this one. And I can pretty much follow the thread, which is not a good idea. You should read every word. But I did happen to read this. And there's that part where after Master was healed of cholera, Asiatic cholera, which is always, almost always fatal. So here he is, he's a little boy, 7, 8 years old perhaps, I don't know. Cholera apparently comes on very fast, and they just had no way to cure it. So, you know, he was just fine recently, and now he's literally on his deathbed, too weak even to raise his hands. And so you think about that. You think about his devoted mother, who was a highly elevated soul. She says, look to my guru, look to my guru, and he'll cure you. So he does. He mentally bows to the guru. Lahiri Mahashaya's light cures him. Then Master turns to his mother. You know, it's like he didn't say thank you, Lahiri, although I'm certainly he did, but he turned to his mother. And what he's in gratitude for her faith that caused him to look there to be saved. But also, what I was thinking when I saw that is the degree to which the balance of light and dark in this world is determined by what each one of us individually does in this world. I recently, this phrase, which is in the book that I've just finished, much of this book is Swami's words, but he says, most people in the world are just waiting to be inspired by someone else's faith. I thought, isn't that a beautiful way to put it? You know, certainly my life was extraordinarily uplifted by Swami Kriyananda's faith. He had so much confidence in the power of God and the power of Guru and the power of our work together and our magnetism, one to create what we were trying to create, which is what you're looking at in an external way, but also in the principle of where there is Dharma, there is victory. Where there is right action, whereas there's a movement toward higher consciousness, we will succeed in having the experience that we long for, because that is the nature of reality. All of this shadow and light, it's in Yogananda's poem Samadhi, it's not on any of these, but it's on the back wall, vanish, the of light and shade is the phrase he uses. Veils, vanish the veils of light and shade. You know, you just pass right over that. And then you think, but the obvious thing to say is light and darkness. But that's not what he says. He says light and shade. And what is shade? Shade is something that blocks the light. You see, it doesn't have an inherent reality. The light is there, something blocks the light. And that's what happens to us. The light is always there, we do something that blocks the light. My friend Linda, I'm dying. I'm going to lose what I love. Somehow death will cause a diminishment of my life experience. And that concept, very concept, creates shade. It's not true, but it creates the feeling of shade. So Swami says, what to pray for? Pray to be in the light. And pray to be aware of the light is what that really means, because it's not created because God says, oh yeah, you're praying really well, I'm going to give you light. It's because when you focus on the light, then that automatically removes the block, because the block is just a perception. Now, this is very simple. This is not very easy, because there's just so much of a long-standing habit. But it's nothing but a habit. Pray to be in the light. And when you are in the light, then you are the light. And everywhere you go, to that extent, shade is diminished. You know, this is a crazy... These transitions between yugas, which is what we're in, all of the people who appear to be doing what they're doing, they're not running the show, thank you. They're not running the show at all. This is being run from a much higher level. In Autobiography of a Yogi and The Path, Swami talks about Babaji and Jesus together have planned the salvation of this age. And they're very concerned about the materialism and the racial prejudice and the wars between... They're very concerned about it. But they have planned the salvation of this age. Whew. But that they can't change the karma of everyone. Everybody has to play it out. And all of the people who are doing things, whatever they are, that you don't like, and everybody dislikes opposite things, but whatever they're doing, they're also children of God. It might be annoying, but that's the fact. You know, Swamiji, in the middle of a horrible period of persecution, was so he reached a dark night of the soul, and he prayed to Babaji. Basically, he said, you know, I don't care what happens to me. I don't even care what happens to the work I've done. I've done it all for Divine Mother. You can take it away if you want to. It's not a consequence to me. But why are you letting these evil people have power over me? That was sort of the point at which, why are you allowing this darkness to dominate the light? And Swami said the answer he got from Babaji was, they are all my children. And that is really something to meditate, isn't it? The worst murderer who leaves one member of the family alive, he's moving forward. And we have that in our background. Everybody, we've all been all things. And God stayed with us and moved us forward. And how do we go forward? We get forward when we see the light. So how do you help when darkness seems to be overtaking the world? You live in the light. And everywhere you go, you be that light. That was Swami's last comment to the nuclear, anti-nuclear war people. He said, I really approve of what you're doing. He said, except you can't create peace by creating fear. Because now you're no longer in the light. Pray to be in the light. Very, very simple prayer. Everything else will follow. God bless you.